there's this very puritanical witch hunt going on in American society about shutting down, I think, any kind of joyous, free understanding of sexuality that has an adult acknowledgement that sometimes things don't go well. Sometimes you wish you hadn't done that. Sometimes you wish you hadn't fucked that guy or that girl. Sometimes you had too much to drink and you said something stupid. Sometimes professional comedians make jokes that land wrong. It feels like in America, the culture is in this weird frenzy of wanting to blame and be offended. And that's not sexy.
Chris Ryan, thank you for joining me on the podcast.
My pleasure, Zach.
So we were actually talking about the phrase conversational condom for remote podcast conversations. And I actually thought a lot about that last night because I didn't start doing remote podcasts until the pandemic hit. And now I probably do them about 50-50, 60-40, like 60% in person. And if we have our way, or if Mark Zuckerberg has his way, we will be sucked into the metaverse and conversational condoms will be the only way we have to communicate. And we'll get let out for an hour a day in the real world, like when prisoners get let out of the metaverse prison. So in a way, we're just getting a head start with the sick, twisted reality that we'll encounter in the metaverse.
Well, maybe you, dude. I'm going to die before that shit hits. That's my plan.
What's your plan if it starts to take hold like 5-10 years from now and you're still like it's come sooner than expected. It's intruding on the van life and you can't get away from it. The Matrix is entering your cocoon of a Matrix and you're like, fuck, what do I do?
Well, you know, that would depend on the particulars of the situation. But I figure, you know, people living in a van in some hidden corner of the desert in Utah are probably going to be the last to get sucked into the Matrix. I think we'll be those, you know, those fringe dwellers. But I've lived all over the world. I lived most of my adult life in Spain, and I've spent a lot of time in Mexico and Southeast Asia and India and all over the place. So I figure, you know, I'm 60 now. If I get another 15, 20 good years, optimistically, I can hide out for that long.
Yeah, I'm thinking about what the next 20, 30 years is going to be like. And I hope that what people believe the metaverse is going to be, where we're maybe having 50 to 75% of our interactions in this sort of digital conference room space, like just like this vapid space that is supposed to feel like real life. I hope that comes after I die too. But lately I've been thinking a lot about, you know, like, is this, if it's going to be around and it's going to be in the middle of my life, because I'm 28 now. So let's say it comes around in like my 40s or 50s, it really starts to ramp up. Do I just lean into it or do I go the route where I kind of live on the fringes and let them try to catch me?
Or, you know, make yourself not really worth catching. That's a good thing too,
yeah.
Right? You know, like of all the animals, I would say the pig is the least lucky because it tastes so good. So you definitely, you don't want to be, you know, something that's tastes really good. You want to be something that's bony and grisly and nobody gives a shit if you wander off. But on a serious level, I mean, that is an interesting question. People ask me that a lot when we're talking about my last book, Civilized to Death, and they want to know like, so, okay, you know, we can't all just go back and be hunter-gatherers. So, you know, what should we do? Should we try to flee civilization or can we make some sort of compromises? And, you know, I do think that there are things that you can take, for example, what you and I are doing right now. That's pretty cool that, you know, you can be sitting wherever you are and I can be in Tbilisi, Georgia, and we can have this conversation. So I don't want to come across as a total Luddite hater of all technology, but I do think that we need to be very careful about promises of progress and, you know, the sort of the propaganda that comes with all these so-called advances, and be very aware of what's being taken away. But I think that with wisdom and, you know, caution, I think we can pick and choose. We can take advantage of certain aspects of advancing technology without getting sucked into the whole sort of vortex of nonsense.
Yeah, I think it's the binary aspect from which people talk about it that scares me the most, especially the technocrats at the top that talk about like it's either the real world and we rot here and the planet continues to decline, or we can create this sort of alternate metaverse reality that we can make whatever we want. And podcasting is really a cool parallel to think about that, because that's what podcasters do now. They either film and record in person, or they film and record remotely. And neither one is where I want to spend the rest of my podcasting career. Like, I love what remote allows me to do, to see someone on a screen, and I could be on the other side of the world. You're in Georgia, I'm in New York. We have this connection that I would say is probably about like 70 to 80% of the magic that would happen in person, but still it's better than nothing.
Yeah.
And then when I have the in-person conversations, then I'm reminded like, oh, this is the in-person energy. This is why I will never go exclusively remote, even if I'm living, you know, quote unquote off the grid. I'd rather have half my guests just talk to them wherever I am, kind of get a feel, do that back and forth. Like when someone says something and you interject in between, yeah. that kind of buffering garble on remote podcasts is all like the in-person energetic magic that you lose. But neither one is where I want to be forever. But the way that some people talk about the metaverse, it's like this is the option, which is fine, but I don't think I think it's just like pushed too hard right now. Like, this is the way.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of like condoms, right? I mean, to return to the origin, there's definitely a time and a place for a condom. And then when you're back to bareback, I guess, then you're like, oh man, oh, I forgot how good this is. But I mean, you know, there's a judicious use of them. You say you don't want to be in either. Why wouldn't you want to just be purely in person if that were possible?
So the way that I think about guests, which may be a flaw in my thinking, but I think about the person first and then the location secondarily. So if I find someone that I'm interested in, if they're in New York, you know, I've probably seen it in their bio, or maybe I've read about them, heard about them, been to an event. Right. And so I'll reach out to them, even in the tri-state area, like just go meet up, you know, a couple hours drive with some equipment. But if I find someone interesting and I find out they're in California or they're in Kuwait, wherever they are, I still want to talk to that person if I can. That's kind of the way I think about it. I'll find the person and I'll be like, all right, what do I have to do to make this happen? And sometimes, you know, you fuck with a condom, and then other times you're like, hey, you know, this is in the moment. I'm right here. You're right here. Yeah. Let's do this right now.
Yeah. Yeah. So if you had like Rogan pull and people would fly from all over the world to sit down in your kitchen there with you, you'd opt for that.
Yeah. Right now I could probably do 3 or 4 guests a year in a Motel 6 where I could like put them up for a couple nights, and like I would make them dinner, or maybe if it's more remote, like we would camp somewhere
and I would just
like make it part of the podcast experience. Like, this is the Auxoro camping podcast where I just sucker people into recording with me.
Yeah, well, that's pretty much my MO. But my approach is different. Like, I'm less interested in pursuing particular guests, and I'm more interested in sort of stumbling upon them. That's what I really like. I like just meeting people through daily life, you know, and they happen to mention that, you know, they used to be married to a Saudi prince, or that they were in a Turkish prison for a few weeks. And then I'm like, what, really? You want to talk about that? Are you free tomorrow? You know, would you be willing? That's how I like to do it. And, you know, I have had famous people on the podcast, of course, and that's always good for pumping up the numbers. And you know, a lot of interesting people are somewhat famous, so I don't mean to poo-poo that too much. But, I like for me, podcasting is like hitchhiking. I like just that sense of discovery, and when the conversation goes off the rails, that's when I really, you know, feel like something's being accomplished here. But I definitely I've interviewed people sitting in the dirt for sure. I interviewed this rattlesnake expert in New Mexico, I think.
Wow.
Maybe it was Arizona. He didn't even want to do the podcast. The only reason he agreed was that his ex-girlfriend was a fan, and she wrote to me and she's like, if I could get this dude to talk to you, would you see him? I was like, sure. And he's like, his whole life is rattlesnakes. That's all he cares about, is rattlesnakes. He's not a professor anywhere. He's not a published expert. He doesn't give a shit about recognition. He just wants to be with the snakes. And he lives in a container in the desert, like a, you know, one of those trucking containers.
Yeah.
And he just gets up in the morning and he goes out and he crawls up in the rocks and checks on the snakes and, you know, checks on the babies and sees how the, you know, they're doing. And he just sort of monitors them, and he's done this for decades. And he agreed to do it, and we met in this campground, and I had a couple of those little camping chairs, and we just sat in the dirt, and I put my recorder between us, and we each had a microphone. And it was really interesting, because it turned out, now this guy's been bitten, I think he said 14 times by snakes.
Oh, Jesus.
By rattlesnakes.
He's got a high tolerance, I'm sure, by now.
Well, I said to him, like, I said, so that's a lot of anti-venom. That's pretty expensive, right? And he said, oh, no, fuck that, man. It's, you get bit, you got at least four vials, and they're about $5,000 each. There's no way I can afford that. I don't even call 911. I said, well, what do you do? And he said, I ride it out.
that's literally the phrase that popped in my head as you were saying that. I was like, does this guy just ride the wave? Like
he rides
just
it out.
Like he gets bit by a rattlesnake, and it's like he just popped Molly at a festival. He's like, all right, 45 minutes till this bitch kicks in. Like,
yeah,
wave is coming.
Better get ready, batten down the hatches.
Yeah,
but the thing that was really interesting about him is that, you know, the more we talked, the more I realized, like, it's not really about snakes. This guy's attracted to facing things he fears. And it turns out, like, he had this whole thing about how he spent a lot of time in nudist colonies because he was ashamed of his body. And so he was attracted to going somewhere where he would be naked all the time in front of strangers. And there was a series of things in his life that were like, oh, I'm afraid of that. Let me go straight at it. You know, he's a really interesting guy.
Hey guys, this is a quick reminder that the two best ways you can support the show are by one, leaving a rating and comment on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. This is like foreplay for the algorithm because it revs it up and makes our show appear higher in searches. And number two, you can subscribe to Auxoro Premium at auxoro.supercast.com, where for $5 a month, you get bonus episodes and more exclusive content. Thank you for however you choose to support the show. Wow. Yeah, I had my first... I don't even know if you wouldn't call this a nudist experience, but I was in a sauna in the Netherlands for an entire day that was completely naked, which I had never done before. I'd never just been like, I've gone in and out of locker rooms. I played baseball almost my entire life. Like, I'm used to being in a locker room full of guys just swinging their cocks around, like fucking just shooting the shit. And I went into the sauna, which was kind of like this luxury co-ed, but naked spa space. And I was worried the whole time. I was like, I'm just gonna pop boners all over the place. Like, this is terrible. How can I relax in the sauna? Like, it's gonna be a shit show. I'm just gonna be like tucking it up into my towel and hiding in the corner. Like, I can't just go into a Turkish steam room just fucking raging and make everyone else uncomfortable. And like 15 minutes in, I realized that this, even though everyone's naked, it's like completely non-sexual. Like it wasn't right. erotic at right. all. It was just people hanging out naked, chatting to naked men, women, all different shapes and body sizes. And you kind of just notice when someone's attractive, but it, for whatever reason, it didn't switch on the erotic part of my brain where I'm like, oh, like I want to, you know, I want to fuck. Like, I want to just like get after it right now. Like, it was just like, oh, that's like, that's something beautiful. That's someone beautiful. And like, oh, there's the next naked person. Like, oh, here's me. Like, I'm sitting here. Like, there are my roles. And it was a very pleasant, relaxing experience. Like, not erotic at all, which was surprising to me.
Yeah, yeah. I mentioned I lived in Spain for a long time. The sort of European approach to nudity and the body, I find so much healthier and refreshing. You know, like breastfeeding in public is just like a non-issue. Even in like countries that are quite sexually repressed, like India, breastfeeding is a non-issue. Mm. You know. It's really a strange American phobia that we have around the body. It's sad. Last time I was in a sauna naked in Holland, I was with Wim Hof. So that was a non-erotic situation for both of us.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, that can turn into erotic pretty quickly because he's the deep breathing, you know, he's the cold guy. The cold, you know, suppresses a lot of the eroticism, but you got that heavy breathing. And but like on a serious note, that's very cool. Like, what Wim Hof seems like, if you're going to do an experience like that, he's the guy to do it with because he has so much time and reps with that type of stuff.
Yeah, he's an awesome dude. I was in Spain and I reached out to that organization to see if I could get them on my podcast. And they said, sure, you know, we'll set up a Zoom call or whatever. And I said, you know, I'd be happy to fly up to Holland. I'd just love to meet him. And I really prefer to do these in person and I'd be happy to fly up there. And they said, okay, well, if you want to fly up, we'll send someone to pick you up at the airport and come out and hang out. And I'm so glad I did because, you know, Wim and I did the podcast and then he's like, okay, hey, you want to get in the barrel? And I was like, all right, let's get in the barrel, man. And I saw all these people like filling it with ice while we were talking. And then we went and we got in the ice barrel and then we got in the sauna and then back in the ice barrel and back in the sauna. And we became buddies and I got to hang out with his son and his daughter and we've become friends and I've hung out all over the world in the years since then. That's probably 5 years ago or something. So that's another benefit of doing the podcast in person when you can, because I feel like, you know, I've made so many friends. My life is so much richer because of people I've met through the podcast, both guests and listeners, you know, who reach out. Especially when I'm in the van, people reach out and say, hey, man, I see you're in Montana. Come by. I've got a place here near Glacier and you can use the washing machine and, you know, take a shower. And then we end up having dinner and we become friends. And then I visit them the next year. And next thing you know, we've been friends for 6 or 7 years and they're a big part of my life.
Yeah. I mean, guys like you have inspired me to start traveling with my podcast gear because you're so open about the fact that you record out of the van, you're doing a lot of things in person. Like you said, you're stumbling upon people. So in the last 6-7 months or so, when I've gone somewhere, I've always taken my pocket Zoom recorder and a couple mics just in case, you know, something goes down. I meet a guy who, you know, rolls on rattlesnake venom or something like that. Like, you never know when.
You never know.
Yeah.
And that's the beauty of travel, you know, like that. I mean, it's fine to see places, but for me, it's about the people you meet. You know, when you're in some weird mountain village somewhere, and you happen to be sitting next to somebody at the cafe who's also, you know, a foreigner, you know they're interesting because they're there, right? If they're just boring, run-of-the-mill, you know, worried about retirement and monkeypox, they'd be back home. They wouldn't be sitting in this cafe in the middle of nowhere. So there's this beautiful filtering mechanism to travel that I love. I think it's not as intense now as it used to be in the 80s before, you know, there was internet and you could text with your mom from, you know, Tibet. But it's still there to some extent. And the technology is great. Like this, I showed you my mic. This is,
yeah,
this
that's
has,
what you use.
This has 8 gigabytes of memory in it as well. So wow. You don't even need the Zoom anymore. I've gone through 3 or 4 Zooms. They're great, but you don't even need that. You just get a few of these and you're set.
Oh yeah, for audio files, 8 gigabytes is like 3 years of podcast right there.
Yeah, yeah.
So I have a plan for about the next hour or so, and we'll see how it goes. So I wanted to get into Sex at Dawn, but before we get into that, I have Civilized to Death right here, and I just wanted to mention to people, you had already mentioned the book. I'm going through it right now. It's an exciting read, like very eye-opening in a lot of ways. And I encourage people to go grab Chris's book because this is the latest one. And then you also have Sex at Dawn, which you published back in 2010, I believe.
Yeah.
Was it 2010? And so I went through the audiobook for Sex at Dawn. So that was my plan, to kind of get into Sex at Dawn and then at the end kind of give a little teaser for Civilized to Death, and then we'll see if we end up doing a round two, we can just pick up where we left off.
Sure.
So to set the stage for Sex at Dawn, is monogamy natural, and what do we know about the ways that early humans fucked?
Well, first of all, we need to define monogamy, right? There's sexual monogamy and there's social monogamy. So when biologists talk about monogamous species, often they're talking about birds. Mm-hmm. What they're referring to is social monogamy. So that's when there's a male and a female that cooperate and raise a brood of chicks together. Now, a lot of the confusion around this came because when biologists are observing these birds, they see the same male, the same female every day, every night with these chicks. They say, okay, that's a monogamous couple raising these chicks together. But in the 70s, when DNA testing started to become affordable, and they went to the nest and they took some of the feathers that had fallen off the chicks and some of the feathers from the purported father and purported mother, what they found was that the DNA corresponded with the mother, but often did not correspond with this male that's helping raise them. So then they started to figure out, okay, this male didn't actually impregnate that female, but socially, this male is taking care of these chicks and raising these chicks. So he's not a biological father, but he's a social or, you know, institutional, structural father, whatever. So that's when the distinction between sexual monogamy and social monogamy started to really get fleshed out a little bit. And we see this in human societies as well. There are definitely societies where men and women will pair bond. And sometimes those pair bonds can last years, or even a lifetime in some cases. but those people are very rarely sexually monogamous. So that's the first distinction you want to make. So in the book, which I wrote with my wife at the time, Casilda Jetta, we weren't arguing that humans never had sacred, long-lasting, emotionally unique relationships. We weren't arguing that humans never pair bonded in prehistory. What we're arguing is that the evidence is overwhelming that our species as a primate evolved in what biologists refer to as a multi-male, multi-female mating system, meaning that we did not pair off in monogamous couples like swans or penguins or these other examples that are sometimes used, and raise our young as a couple. That in fact, we raise children cooperatively within the hunter-gatherer band.
So we had the social web and we had the sexual web, and those would overlap at many points. Like people are hanging out, their early humans are forming these emotional bonds. They're not monogamous in the emotional sense, but they also weren't monogamous in the sexual sense. Like people were much more free, much more sharing. Those emotional sexual connections were much more harder to distinguish. Yeah. Back then, that is that a good way to do it? Like there wasn't so much of a separation. Like this is who I hang out with, and this is who I fuck, and like those never meet. It's like that would kind of intermingle.
Right. There's a lot of overlapping, you know, circles of intimacy. And in fact, you know, when you look at humans as a mammal or even as a primate, we're very unusual in the fact that we have sex when the female cannot get pregnant, right? So we have sex when the female's already pregnant, when she's not ovulating, when she's postmenopausal, when she's breastfeeding. These are all cases in which she cannot get pregnant. So what's the point of having sex, right? Most mammals only have sex when the female is ovulating. And there are all sorts of ways that the female signals this to the males. Otherwise, it's a waste of energy. And it's, you're very vulnerable. You know, if you're having sex, you're not paying attention to predators. You're not worried about what that sound was, you know, that twig snapping 20 feet away. You're focused on the sex, right?
Yeah.
So in terms of evolutionary logic, there's no point to have sex unless the female can get pregnant. It's just a huge waste of energy. It turns out that the only mammals that have sex for non-recreative or non-reproductive purposes are humans, bonobos, and chimpanzees, which are our two most closely related primates, and dolphins. And all of them, including us, all of those species are highly intelligent, highly social species in which sex has been co-opted from a purely reproductive purpose to a social purpose of maintaining these intimate bonds within a functioning group of individuals. So in humans, it's hunter-gatherer bands. And dolphins, it's a pod, and chimps and bonobos, they're, you know, these bands of individuals. And there are over 200 species of primate, to give some context to this, over 200 species of primates, many of which live in complex social groups in which there are multiple adult males. And precisely none of them are sexually monogamous. None. So, you know, it's a weird situation because, you know, when Sex at Dawn came out, a lot of people were saying, oh, that's an extraordinary, that's ridiculous argument. You know, it's so blah, blah, blah. But actually, the extraordinary argument is that we would be the only exception among all primates. We would be the only one that have, you know, multi-adult males living in the social group that is sexually monogamous. It doesn't exist in any other species of primate. And then if you start to look at, you know, there are all sorts of sources of data that support this argument, ranging from, you know, our sexual morphology to contemporary psychosexual research to, you know, obviously primates and their behavior and the anthropological data about hunter-gatherers. It all points to the same picture, which is that we evolved and lived for hundreds of thousands of years as anatomically modern humans in a far more permissive, promiscuous sexual atmosphere than what we've got now. And the repression that we have now is very unusual and recent. And that's why it's so difficult. That's why porn is a multi-billion dollar industry and always has been, right? There's a really fascinating book called The Erotic Engine. I forget the author's name, but he points out that every advance in photographic technology has been funded by the human fascination with nudity. So the earliest photographs are all pictures of naked women. And there was all this demand for it. So all this investment and money coming in so they could perfect early photography. And then the first motion pictures were, you know, short films of people fucking, and that brought in all this money and all this demand. And so if you look at each advance in this, you know, right up to like how to take people's money on the internet, how can you get people to pay on the internet in order to watch these videos? That was porn. That was the first people facing this and figuring out these technical problems. It was all porn.
I just want to say I was listening to a podcast recently with this guy who was a career dark web online scammer, like a career criminal in terms of reaching out to people, faking identities, getting vulnerable people to give him their money. And he's been doing this for 20, 30 years. And in terms of when email first came on board, that introduction of a new technology, he was saying that the first uses of email, because the FBI wasn't paying attention to it yet, it was so new. This is back in like the early mid 90s. The first uses of that were porn and criminal activity, like connecting the communication between groups of people who are doing shady shit, and then also sending pornographic photos around, you know, tits, ass, things like that. So it's funny how when these new technologies come around, the first thing our mind goes to as humans is like, oh, like, how can I get away with some shit? And how can I send tits? Oh, here's email. Let me do this. How can I send a dick pic? Let me do this.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, obviously, people who are arguing that, you know, sex is only for having babies and it's a small part of human experience and, you know, only happens in a context of a sacred union before God or whatever, it seems to me those people have a real uphill battle to prove that perspective.
Yeah. And it's crazy how sex education, or whatever sex education there is in, you know, middle school, high school, which is barely anything, but that education focuses on the preventing the reproductive aspect of sex, even though that's what, like less than 1% of the times that we have sex as humans is when we're trying to have a kid. And there's like this super intense puritanical focus on this is, you know, abstinence is the best. Then second is condoms, birth control, like all this stuff. And then, by the way, sometimes people fuck for pleasure, but like we're not gonna talk to you about that. Like, you figure that out on your own, figure out the positions, like where this goes, where that goes. Like, all you need to know is how not to get pregnant.
Yeah, yeah. Again, this is America. I think in Sex at Dawn, there's a section where we sort of compare, this could be in Civilized to Death, but where we compare the Dutch and the American approaches to sexual education and teen dating and all this kind of stuff. And like in Holland, 15, 16 year olds, you know, they get into a relationship. The parents want to meet the boy and they'll have him, invite him over for dinner. And if they like him and, you know, they get a good feeling about him, he's welcome to spend the night, you know, in the girl's room. and they'll talk to them about birth control. It's very, you know, like everything in Dutch culture, it's harm reduction, right? It's not denial. It's like, okay, they're going to fuck, right? 16-year-old, 15-year-old, yeah, whatever, if they want to, we can't stop them. So let's help them.
Yeah, it's like you shake the dad's hand, the boyfriend says hello, and the dad says, I know you're going to fuck my daughter. Just have a, you know, be safe. Hello. And then you go, yeah, off and you just fucking do whatever. It's like no tension around it, it seems like. From what I've heard.
And you know you're going to have breakfast with them, so you better be a gentleman. You know,
it's like, yeah,
it just works better. And the rates of teen, yeah, pregnancy and sexually contracted disease and all that are minuscule in Holland compared to the U.S. So, yeah, obviously our system doesn't work. It's not based upon effectiveness. It's based upon, you know, all sorts of emotional triggers that we Americans have, just like the breastfeeding thing. You know, it's, there's a very, I feel like America is a culture created by 14-year-old boys. You know, it's just,
it basically is with TikTok now. They're retaking over the culture.
Yeah, it's incredible. Like the fascination with violence and sex, but also the sort of inability to approach these things from a mature, balanced perspective is really perplexing.
Yeah. I will say though, the one thing I've noticed about people, the generation younger than me, I guess that's Generation Z. I'm at the tail end of millennial. So I've noticed that people who were born after the year 2000, like a lot of my cousins, you know, people I've just come across, hearing parents talk about it and shit like that, kids nowadays have a much better bullshit detector, I think, because they're growing up with the internet, that they're so hard to fool. So in a way, the digital world is destroying their brains because they're growing up with the technology. But at the other end of that spectrum, they're being exposed to so much information that you're basically forced to develop that bullshit detector from 8 years old, because that's when you're going to have a smartphone and you start getting access to the entire universe of digital technology, whatever, porn, fucking books, podcasts, whatever. So it's a double-edged sword. It's like you're getting more information, you're learning how to sift through it, but at the other end of that is like our attention spans are now wired for these 30-second clips.
Yeah, I don't know. I grew up obviously without the internet. The internet started when I was in my mid-30s. And, you know, so didn't really kick in. Like I probably didn't have a smartphone till I was 40, early 40s. Mm. So it's really hard for me to imagine what it's like to grow up in this environment technologically. You know, I think it's probably impossible to understand it, because it's not just dealing with the technology, it's that your brain actually forms in the presence of the technology. And so your conception of reality is different, you know, just as it's different for someone like me growing up with television versus someone who grew up with no television, right? Like even television, we had a sense of like, oh, that's what Vietnam looks like. That's what's happening in the war. Those are, you know, bombs exploding in this country thousands of miles from here. It's as you say, it's definitely a double-edged sword, but it's really interesting to try to project into the experience of somebody who's growing up in a totally different world. It's very strange. And that's something that we talk about in both books. That the sort of generational change, you know, here you are, would you say you are 25 or something?
28. I look 27 though.
Not a day over 26 and a half.
Yeah.
When, you know, you're talking about kids these days and you're 28. So it's like already there's a gap between you and the people you're referring to, right? Mm. Whereas hunter-gatherers, for hundreds of thousands of years, the things your father dealt with are the same things you're dealing with, right? It was the same snakes, the same bears, the same, you know, healing medicines, the same everything. It was the same life. You're in the same environment. Nothing really changed. And there's a great book called Don't Sleep, There Are Snakes by Daniel Everett, who is a...
Is this the rattlesnake guy?
No, no. Totally different.
I would imagine he doesn't get a lot of sleep.
Yeah. No, he seems like a pretty relaxed guy. I don't know. But anyway, Daniel Everett was he's still alive. He's a really interesting dude. He was a Christian missionary and very gifted linguist. And he learned the language of the Pinaha people of the upper Amazon, which is a very difficult language to learn because it's so different from any other known language. And he's one of the only white people who speaks it. And he went and lived with them. And they're like way, way up, way out in the middle of nowhere, hunter-gatherer group. And he went there to convert them to Christianity, right? But they're really interesting people because they live very much in the present. And like literally, they don't talk about the past more than what your father told you. So if your father, so when this guy Everett went in, he started talking to them about Jesus. They said to him, he tells the story of, they're like, okay, Daniel, did you know Jesus? And he says, oh, no, no, Jesus lived long ago. And did your father know Jesus? No, no, he lived long before my father. And then he said, Daniel, then stop talking to us about Jesus. Like, it doesn't matter. It has no relevance to our lives. I forget why I'm talking about
saying that your father's problems were your problems in hunter-gatherer society.
Right. So Everett, who now teaches at MIT, I believe, or Harvard, somewhere in Boston, he talked about how they're the happiest people that he's ever seen. And he was trying to think, like, why are they so happy? Because their life isn't particularly easy, right? I mean, sometimes there's not enough food. They're living in these little huts. And he says, but they laugh all the time. Like, if their hut blows down in a rainstorm, they laugh. If they catch a fish, they laugh. If they don't catch a fish, they laugh. Everything, they're just laughing all the time. And he said, I think the reason they're so relaxed is that it's not that their lives are not without challenges. It's that the challenges are familiar. And so they know they can handle whatever comes their way. Whereas in our lives, the challenges are unfamiliar. They're always new. Everything's new. I can't use my fucking phone because Android updated the software and I can't take it apart and fix it. And I don't know if the Wi-Fi stops working. I don't know what to do if my car breaks down, if I get audited by the IRS. I mean, there are a million things that can happen that I have no idea how to deal with, you know?
Yeah.
Whereas in a hunter-gatherer group, it's like, I know how to hunt. I know how to forage. I know how to build a hut. I know how to make a fire. I know how to deliver a baby. I know what to do if I get bit by a snake. I know how to die. You know, I mean, it's just like, it's the same stuff. So there's a comfort in that familiarity.
Yeah. No, your father's problems are your problems in hunter-gatherer societies. That's an interesting way to think about it. And from what we know, it seems like it's true. I'm watching the show Succession right now. Have you ever watched it?
Yeah.
So when I think about your father's problems or your problems, Succession is like one of the extremes of one side of that spectrum, where you grow up in this billionaire, super wealthy family. As a kid, you're protected from all of your father's problems until you hit that age of like 18, 21, where you get thrusted into the company. And then it's the whole show is about all this fucking backstabbing and learning how to navigate the business world and the type of shit that comes with having the problems of all this money. But in a way, the kids don't really get to experience their father's problems because he built it long before they were alive. Right. And the kids kind of just get thrust into this world and they figure it out, which is a good problem to have, figuring out where to put your billions and how to handle that. And then you have the other end of the spectrum, which you have hunter-gatherers where, you know, you're born as soon as you could walk. You're like, all right, now we got to go fucking get some food, pick some berries. You got to learn how to light a fire, like all the administrative bullshit that normally wouldn't enter your mind until around the age of 16, 18, 20 years old. It seems like you basically just get thrust into that as an early human.
Yeah. Although I don't know if thrust is the way I think of it, because, you know, if you look at kids playing, you look at any animal playing, what they're doing is learning how to be an adult. Right. So, you know, I was just a couple of weeks ago, I was in Tanzania and I spent a day with a Hadza group of hunter gatherers. And you see the kids, you know, the little boys have little bows and arrows and they're shooting and they're, you know, practicing and getting their skills and they're running around and they're building fires and they're throwing rocks. And, you know, the same thing that little boys do everywhere, you know, and little girls have little dolls or little, you know, sticks that they pretend are babies and they're learning nurturing behavior and they're looking at the adults and sort of mimicking their behavior. We do that naturally. So as opposed to, you know, succession, you know, we're not sort of like born knowing how to run a meeting with the legal team, you know, we don't necessarily find ourselves attracted to that. And I think one of the interesting things about that show is how being, you know, they really make the point of being this kind of Rupert Murdoch backstabbing, you know, bloodthirsty cocksucker doesn't come naturally to all the kids. You know, some of them, they're trying to do it, but it's not in their nature. They don't want to disappoint dad, but they're also, you know, I forget the actors. I stopped watching it like 2 years ago when it stopped, you know, advancing.
But
the younger one who's kind of like goofy, funny guy.
Yeah. Roman.
Yeah. I mean, it's really funny to see how he, you know, he's just so ill-suited for it. He's just too nice a guy. He's too quirky and funny, and he's never, you know, none of them are really well-suited for it. But, So anyway, I think there's a built-in fascination with mimicking the adults when the adults are doing natural human things like hunting and fishing. You know, why is it that on our vacations, we do the things that hunter-gatherers do all the time? Right? Like we go camping, we go hunting, we go fishing, you know, even golf is arguably basically a hunter-gatherer activity. You know, it's small groups of men wandering over a seemingly natural environment with some, you know, mutual goal that they're, you know, they could be hunting impalas or, you know, trying to get a birdie on the back nine, you know, it's the same thing.
Yeah. Or double bogey. The way that I play, it's definitely a lot more gathering than hunting down the hole.
Yeah.
That's a good point. Like we spend our time doing the things that we think we have to do in the way that we're told to do it. And then once we are hit with any sort of free time where we could exercise our own freedom, then almost everybody reverts to, you know, let me hop on a plane and go to the fucking beach, or let me go on a trek. Let me just go sit and fish for a day, hiking, like all these things to reconnect to nature that we don't get a chance, or most people don't. I don't even want to say don't get a chance to do, because everyone in some way is autonomous as long as it's not like a slave situation or something like that. But we choose to do these things, and it seems like that we just kind of follow through with these pressures. And then when the pressure gets let off, then you see how our mind really gravitates and how our body really gravitates. Like we get pulled back towards the nature.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think it's pretty obvious that that's the sort of default setting of our minds and our bodies. There's all sorts of research about, you know, I think in Japan it's called nature bathing, you know, like, but years ago, I remember reading research, the people in hospitals who were controlled for other for factors like age and diagnosis and all this stuff, what they found was that people in hospitals who had a view of trees outside the window healed at a significantly faster rate than people who didn't have trees outside the window, who just had like another building or something. So it's, I mean, it's just everywhere that, you know, the idea that we're not animals and that we don't resonate with the environment in which we evolved is absurd. And yet, if you really pay attention, you start to see that that's the premise underlying so many ideas about humans, you know, that we're machines that can be fixed and tuned up and have our parts replaced and all that. And that's just not the case.
Yeah. Yeah. And speaking of being connected to nature, or at least using the nature, one of your main arguments in the book is that in Sex at Dawn is that the agricultural revolution was this tipping point where humans started to settle down in the same place. We became more possessive. We were more free and sharing everything as hunter-gatherers. And then sex was an extension of that. And then we became much more monogamous once the agricultural revolution came around. And my kind of like the things that were popping into my head while I'm reading this is like, yes, the agricultural revolution, it does seem like once people's roles are more solidified into this power dynamic, monogamy makes sense. Like you start to exchange things like sex for things like shelter, food, things like that. Like it's much more of a power balance and resource kind of battle. But also when you're in the same place for a long period of time and you're safe, to me, that's when I feel the most creative. And like also like when you're not afraid for your life, when you're not worried about survival, other things start to pop in your head. So one part of me thinks like, wouldn't I just be sitting around all day like thinking about sex and threesomes and like how could I, you know, fuck the other dude's wife and like engage in kind of be creative with my sex life? Like was there any of that with the agricultural revolution? Like yes, there seems to be monogamy as a result of that, but also once people can be in the same place for a long period of time, sexual, it seems like that would be rife for sexual just like debauchery.
Well, okay, let's look at your fantasy here in some detail. Yeah.
Yes, and I want to be clear. I have zero research to back this up. This is just when I'm underlining something and I write something in the fold of the book, I'm like, oh, that's not based on anything, but I'll just say it.
Why not?
Yeah.
You know, I think it kind of might work the opposite way, because what happened with the advent of agriculture, you know, you said that agriculture brought about monogamy, but it's important to note that it only really brought about female monogamy, not male monogamy. And until very recently, monogamy only referred to a married woman not having sex with anyone other than her husband. It had no reference to what the husband did. The husband could be having sex with the slaves and the concubines and the prostitutes. And as long as his wife is only having sex with him, he's in a monogamous marriage, according to that definition. So the reason that females became subjected to sexual monogamy with agriculture is twofold. First of all, they lost their status relative to men. In hunter-gatherer groups, women are at least on an equal footing with men in terms of autonomy and decision-making power and so on. This is partly because women bring in more of the food that hunter-gatherers eat than men do. So no man's going to tell you what to do if you're feeding him, basically. And secondly, women knew how to do what needed to be done. They know how to build shelters. They know how to find food. They know how to build fires. Men are helpful, but not essential. and no one controlled access to the necessities of life, right? So the way things are set up now, if you get fired or you don't have access to money, suddenly you're out of your apartment, you don't have any food, you can't pay for your car, your whole life's fucked. But in hunter-gatherers, you know, food's all around, medicine is all around, shelter's all around. Like, how are you going to cut me off? There's no way. So there, you don't have this coercive power structure in hunter-gatherers that you then get with agriculturalists, where there's a harvest, the harvest is stored, it's protected, someone's in charge of distributing it, you have to wait a year until the next harvest. And so people aren't independent in the same way and don't have their own access to resources. So women lost status relative to men and became essentially breeding livestock because men started to understand that sex resulted in pregnancy. Until then, it's not clear that humans really understood. There's some controversy around this. I just was speaking to Franz de Waal, the famous primatologist, a week ago about this, and he seems to think that humans always knew that sex caused pregnancy. But my understanding of the research is very different. There are groups that thought that women got pregnant when they stepped over a smoky fire. There are all sorts of belief systems around women who could get pregnant by several men. It's called partible paternity. They believe that the fetus is literally made of accumulated semen. So women who wanted to have a child who was funny and smart and good looking and strong would have sex with the funny dude and the smart dude and the good looking dude and the strong dude to get some of each of those guys. And then when she got pregnant, when she gathered up enough semen that it turned into a fetus and she had the baby, these guys would all recognize their shared fatherhood of this child. It's quite common in the Amazon and also in Papua New Guinea. So anyway, but with the advent of agriculture, you know, people started to see, well, that black bull was fucking that white cow, and now we've got these black and white calves. Oh, I see what's going on here, right? So once they saw that, and they've got property, right? They've got livestock, they've got land, they've got a stone shelter that they've built. The men are thinking, well, I want to leave this stuff to my son, right? And the only way I can know that's my son is to control her sexual behavior. And so that's when you get this very coercive men controlling women thing going on. So anyway, that's all just to sort of unpack this idea that monogamy does not refer to male behavior. It only refers to female behavior.
Yeah, so it was one-sided after the agricultural revolution. Guys could go out, fuck whoever they wanted pretty much, and then if their wife tried to do the same thing, they would call her a witch, and that was that.
Yeah.
Wait, rich guys, now, yeah.
So think about, you know, in these societies, you know, even in Rome, something like 95% of the population of Rome were slaves. So our understanding of these ancient societies is very much seen through the eyes of historians or people alive then who were writing, who were all very, very much upper class, right? The top 1 or 2% in terms of, you know, access to resources and so on. So most men weren't fucking anybody. Most men were slaves. So their lives were miserable. So if you're talking about, you know, Nero or somebody, you know, some rich Roman or ancient Greek or someone in a, you know, Old Testament society that had slaves and concubines, yeah, they could do what they wanted. And they were expected to have multiple wives. I mean, if you look in the Old Testament, it says, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife, right? That famous line. But if you read it in context, it says, nor his house, nor his sheep, nor his goats, nor his cattle. So his wife is just one of your neighbor's possessions that you're not supposed to covet. That's not about respecting the sanctity of marriage. That's about don't steal your neighbor's stuff. you know, and you could get in a lot of trouble, up to and including death, for having sex with someone else's wife. It was seen as a property crime.
Was female promiscuity one of the signs of being a witch? Like, I can't remember what podcast I was listening to, but when the printing press was invented, apparently, after the Bible being the most popular printed book, apparently it was witch hunting guides. Like, that's kind of what popularized the witch, the kind of like witch hunt era. Was not just people looking for witches, but also the printing press was allowing this information to be distributed widely. I can't remember if in the, when I looked it up, it included promiscuity as a signal of being a witch or not, but like, it sounds like something that would be in that book. Like, if she sleeps with my friend, you know, Burner, she's a witch or something like that.
Yeah, there was a lot of anti-sex energy in those early, you know, witch hunting guides, and a lot of it was channeled through the concept of the succubus and the incubus, which were spirits that would come to you in your dreams and have sex with you. The succubus came to men in a female form and extracted their semen in the form of a wet dream, and then would take that semen and then go and appear to a woman in her dream and impregnate her with it. And so this is a very interesting sort of narrative that explains how, you know, different women in the village are getting pregnant and the babies look like men who aren't their husbands. You know, the succubus came to me, took my sperm, then flew over to your house and, you know, put it in your wife. I had nothing to do with it, man. I was asleep.
It seems completely logical. This creature in the middle of the night that didn't even take me out for drinks, just sucked me off in my dreams. Exactly. Is that where the phrase sucked off comes from? Succubus? Like, I wouldn't be surprised if that's like a correlation. But yeah, I mean, the shit that people attributed to things like promiscuity or diseases, things like that, things that we didn't really have a well thought out explanation for, of human behavior, things like that. It's wild when you look back and you look at some of the ways that we attributed that to, like the buckets that we would just drop shit in, like, yeah, that's witchcraft, like confidently just drop that in. And I probably would have done the same thing if I was alive back then, because we have the benefit of looking back, but it's pretty wild to think about.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, let's not forget, we're talking about the medieval period now. Sex was dangerous in the medieval period. A lot of women died in childbirth. Syphilis was a major issue. Gonorrhea became a serious issue. Syphilis and gonorrhea, I think, came back with from the New World with Columbus and the first sort of Spanish conquistadors. They brought that back to Europe. But yeah, there's a lot of difficulty around that. A lot of children died in infancy and or were killed through infanticide and abandonment. You know, lots of pain around pregnancy and childbirth. So yeah, we have I've often argued that Western society in particular, and maybe even more generally, Homo sapiens, modern Homo sapiens, are a species reeling from PTSD. That we, you know, we tell ourselves this story. We have this narrative that I talk about in Civilized to Death, of civilization being this wonderful, fantastic gift to humanity, whereas in fact, it's just been a series of disasters and traumatic experiences for everybody involved. And, you know, and we just can't sort of recover from the trauma. It's just one trauma after another. And we display all the behavior of someone suffering from severe PTSD, both on individual level and even on a governmental level. You know, like, you look at what's happening as we speak, July 20th, record-breaking temperatures all over the world. And, you know, the United States government just sank the most modest gesture toward any kind of response to climate change. It's just like, no, off the table. We got, you know, and gas prices are too high. It's absolute inability to respond to reality.
Yeah. And I wonder how much the violence in poor communities is attributed to people just living in this constant or heightened state of trauma because they don't really have the resources to deal with it. You can't get a therapist on BetterHelp for like $50 a session. Maybe you can't afford that. You're not told that the things you're experiencing can actually be linked to some sort of trauma that happened in your childhood or maybe recently an injury, car accident, something like that. Like even if it's just psychological, and like all the people that are just wandering around without the resources thinking that this is just how life is and there's nothing to do about it without any sort of direction or resource to be able to handle trauma.
Yeah, well, it sounds like you're talking about learned helplessness, you know. Do you know about that concept?
I've heard about it, but I don't know the definition.
So it's horrible experiments that were done, I think, in the 1950s. I don't remember the scientists involved, but basically they had dogs in cages and they had electrified the floor of the cages. And some of the dogs would give a stimulus, like there would be a tone or a sound or something. And then 2 seconds later, they'd shock the dog, right? So it'd be like, beep, chow, you know? And so the dog would hear this tone and be like, oh shit, here it comes. And bah, it would get it. And the dogs would learn to anticipate this, of course. And then they had other dogs where they would play the tone and they would shock them, but there was no relationship. The shocks would just come randomly and the tones would come randomly. And what they found was that the dogs, they got shocked the same amount of times, right? But the dogs that could anticipate it were not as traumatized as the dogs who had no way to know when it was coming. So that demonstrated that it wasn't the shock per se that traumatized the dogs. It was the lack of knowing when it was going to happen or how it was going to come. This is called learned helplessness, where you learn that there's just no way you can protect yourself. And that loss of control, that total absence of being able to defend yourself is what really fucks us up, much more than the trauma itself.
Yeah. So it's like the unknown that makes the trauma feel worse than it actually is. Like it can still be pretty bad, but when you have no idea it's coming, that just amplifies it.
Yeah. It's like if you know you've got to go to the dentist next week and get a tooth pulled, it sucks, but you know, you kind of get ready and you go and it happens and then you recover and you're all right. But imagine if some guy just came into your apartment right now and grabbed you and said, let's go, and threw you down on a chair. And you knew that could happen anytime, you know, get your teeth pulled out. Like that's a totally different thing. Right. And so I think, you know, what you're talking about is people, and I would say not just people in economically challenging situations, everybody, and this relates back to what we were saying earlier about hunter gatherers having the same problems their fathers had, right? Previous generations, we're all dealing with this learned helplessness, right? We, you know, we don't know what's coming next. Is this monkeypox thing going to shut down the world again? You know, is Miami going to be underwater in 2 weeks? Is Joe Biden like a zombie?
Going to be alive?
Yeah, exactly.
Is he alive right now?
Is he alive right now? I mean, you know, we have no control over what's happening. And you know, we're in this historical moment where we're sort of circling the drain in so many ways, and it's just going faster and faster and feels more and more out of control. I think we're all dealing with this. And then you have the question of multi-generational trauma, right? It's been demonstrated in studies that if you traumatize mice, you know, by basically torturing them in different ways, or, you know, forcing them to withstand like famine, not let them eat and so on. Five generations later, their pups are still demonstrably reactive to that trauma.
Oh, wow. So it actually gets passed down in the genes.
Right. And this has been shown in humans with studies of people in Holland, I think it was, during World War II, who were in refugee camps where there wasn't enough food and they were, you know, near starvation. They looked at their descendants and found they had a much higher than average incidence of obesity, including descendants who were adopted, who had been adopted. Mm. So it wasn't just that in the family, there was this sort of familial memory of great hunger, so we eat more. It's that the body, there are epigenetic changes in the body that respond to this, and those get passed down in the DNA to the to the offspring. So I mean, even if your life is calm and your parents are great to you and you didn't get, you know, beat up when you were a kid and you always had enough and you felt safe and all that, you could still be carrying trauma from your parents or your grandparents or your great grandparents. Who knows what kind of shit they went through.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we're a pretty traumatized species.
Yes, no doubt about that. And speaking about circling the drain, I don't know. I hope we're not just circling the drain to our own demise as a species. I'm hopeful that we aren't. But honestly, you know, there's a lot of signs that could go either way. But I wanted to ask you, in terms of where we're at today, sexually and relationship-wise. So if you look back at what we were just talking about, what you corrected me on with the agricultural revolution being tied to this sort of one-sided monogamy where males can do whatever they want, the rich males can do whatever they want, and the females still had that subjugated pressure of being like property. Then if you have the industrial revolution, it seems like that revolution was tied to more of women being able to flex some power, having some more money, men go off to war, women are kind of holding it down back home, and that came with some more sexual freedom for women. And if you look at today, people say that we are in the middle of a consciousness revolution with information, artificial intelligence, the metaverse, like all that shit. Where are we today in terms of our sexual relationships? Like if you want to call it monogamy 3.0, like the shit that we're currently doing with each other, where do you think we are today, and what's your outlook for the near future?
Well, yeah, it depends what you mean by we, right? If you're talking about American society, I think that's a specific situation.
Let's do America first.
Yeah, well, I think America's
spoken
a
like
weird...
a true American. Let's do America first.
Yeah, we're number one after all.
No other country has ever done anything great.
I think the United States is. It's such a weird country. I have a Spanish friend. I lived in Spain for 20 some years. And so when I look at the US, it's kind of like from Europe in some ways. And I had this friend, the Spanish friend, we were talking about America one time. And he said, Chris, the best thing and the worst thing about your country is that you have no sense of the ridiculous. And I said, what do you mean by that? He's like, well, you know, like Jimi Hendrix could only have been American. No Spanish guy would ever have thought like, well, fuck it. I'm left-handed. I'm going to string the guitar backwards, you know, and then like, fuck it while I'm playing it and play with my tongue. Like, you know, that's just not going to happen in Spain. Right. But on the other hand, you know, George Bush Jr. would never be president, you know, or prime minister of Spain. Like we would just look at him and be like, that guy's a buffoon. There's nobody's going to vote for him. So, you know, there's this thing about America where the pendulum swings further. You know, I think the pendulum swings in all cultures, but in America, it just seems to be like really swinging far. So, you know, in the 70s, late 60s, early 70s, you had this real sense of sexual freedom, and people were having a lot of fun, and, you know, key parties and, you know, all that kind of stuff was going on. And then, of course, you had AIDS, and this pendulum swung the other way with the Reagan revolution and all this kind of Christian fundamentalism coming into political culture. And I feel like what's happening now is that a lot of the sexual repression is coming from the side that used to be supporting sexual freedom. So there's all this weird shit where, like, Aziz Ansari has a bad date and suddenly his career's over, you know, or like there's all this shaming and shutting down. You know, Woody Allen is a monster who's never been convicted of anything. The people who investigated him in both cases in New York and Connecticut, the government who investigated him said, there's nothing here. There's no evidence. We're not even going to bring charges. And yet, you know, all these actors are saying, I'll never work with Woody Allen again. I'm ashamed I've ever worked. Like, what the fuck? Whatever happened to innocent until proven guilty, you know? Yeah. There's this very puritanical witch hunt going on in American society about shutting down, I think, any kind of joyous, free understanding of sexuality that has an adult acknowledgement that sometimes things don't go well. Sometimes you wish you hadn't done that. Sometimes you wish you hadn't fucked that guy or that girl. Sometimes you had too much to drink and you said something stupid. Sometimes professional comedians make jokes that land wrong. Like, it feels like in America, the culture is in this weird frenzy of wanting to blame and be offended. And that's not sexy. So I'm sorry for people your age who are going through this shit, because it's like, that's not a good party to go to. I can't imagine that's a lot of fun, like dating and worrying that you're going to be destroyed if you say the wrong thing or you touch someone's breast without getting a signed consent form. That's definitely not sexy. So I think that, you know, American society is in this weird place where there's this sort of culture of shame that's very strong right now. But on the other hand, I know that there are a lot of people who opt out of that. And I think that there's a, you know, in a microcosm in sexuality, it's sort of a reflection of a macro view of this, of the sort of collapse of Western civilization, which is that, yeah, the structures are fucked up and corrupted and tottering and falling apart. And that's potentially horrible. But what it does is it opens up opportunities for us to form our own sort of enclaves. We can, because the overall structures are weakened, we're free to form our own answers, to form our own little communities. So when Sex at Dawn came out, for example, I've often said that if it had come out 10 years earlier, I don't think anybody would have read it, because people still believed monogamy worked. But by
and
the
here
time
I am reading it 10 years later.
Yeah, right. And 10 years later, it's probably like, oh, this is fucking obvious, you know? But yeah. I think when it came out, people were like, it was just after the Clintons, you know, and there's all this Monica Lewinsky and all this kind of stuff was happening. And people were ready to say, well, you know what? Maybe this conventional marriage thing doesn't work, because everybody I know is either divorced or miserable. There are very few happy married people, you know? And so when these institutions break down, it creates opportunity for creative response. And so I think people are doing that both in terms of relationship and in terms of living arrangements and career path and, you know, nutrition and all sorts of things. People are finding their own ways because the major structures have fallen apart.
Yeah. And speaking of the Aziz Ansari thing and what it's like to be a 20-something-year-old navigating dating and sex today. So my take on it is that the people that are yelling on Twitter and posting things like Aziz Ansari deserves to be you know, lumped into the same crowd as Harvey Weinstein and all those guys. Like, there's zero nuance. I think that's like a very small percentage of people that are actually walking around. Like, I've never met someone in person that's thought that Aziz Ansari doesn't deserve to, you know, did anything wrong. Like, it was just a regretful sex occurrence that was tossed into this snowballing clickbait Me Too thing. And there are a lot of very positive changes that came from Me Too with disgusting guys in power that were checked, and they had to deal with that. And there were a lot of women who were victims of that. But in terms of Aziz Ansari and what it's like to date today as a 25, 28, 30 year old, I still feel very sexually free. I don't feel like I'm being constricted in any way. I'm in a beautiful monogamous relationship right now, but for the first, you know, 26 years of my life, I was pretty much single, and I was dating in Brooklyn, which is one of the liberal hotspots of the world, dating on Hinge, going on multiple dates a week, you know, spending nights with, you know, many lovely ladies, and we had each other's company. You know, we did the dance, and I never felt like this sort of fear in the back of my mind, like, does she, like, is this gonna turn into a thing, or like, is this okay? Like, I would always make sure I had consent, but I wasn't like questioning, like, can I put my hand here, like, can I, is it okay if I spank you this hard, like, it's, you know, if a girl's starting to choke me, like, it's pretty safe to assume that, like, she may be wanting to be on the receiving end of a choke, and you test the waters with that. Yeah. But yeah, like, I think for me personally, I felt very sexually free and able to have these incredible experiences, because I think most women don't really think like that. Like, they want to have great sex, and there's something that's very unattractive about being cautious and constantly checking in. And 95% of the language from sex comes from body language. Like, when you have multiple partners, like, you know, I'm talking to Chris Ryan, so I'm preaching to someone who doesn't need to hear this, but, you know, from my perspective, body language is the number one in terms of how you're reading situations in the bedroom. Like, it's that Bill Burr bit where a girl's saying, like, oh, like, stop it. Like, they're kind of like being sexy with you. If you read that transcript in court, like, no, stop it. Don't do that. Like, that is, yeah, it looks horrible. But in the moment, she could be like, no, stop it. And like, putting her hand on your cock, like, you're looking for these body language signals, and most women are willing to just go with the flow, and they'll say, I'm not into this if it comes up, or I might say, you know what, I'm not really into this. But for the most part, it's like two people going at it as humans, and like, animalistic. Sometimes it's rougher, sometimes it's more sensual, but I haven't really felt constricted from the Me Too movement. Like, it's, and like those sort of accusations with Aziz Ansari, like, it's been eye-opening to see what goes on in those positions of power. But at the, you know, the level of the average Joe going around and hooking up with average Josephinas, like, I think everything's still pretty much like it always was.
Oh, that's good to hear. At least in Brooklyn.
Yeah, in Brooklyn. I mean, I've been to, you know, I spent my college years in Virginia, but I've only lived in New York and Virginia. I've traveled to a bunch of other places, but I can speak best to Brooklyn, New York.
Yeah. Well, that's good. My sort of, you know, where I came of age, I think, in those terms, was in Spain. So, America seems kind of dangerously repressed in those terms. Yeah. But it's weird for me, you know, because I mean, I've been living in the States off and on since Sex at Dawn came out. But, you know, I've always been that Sex at Dawn guy since then. So that's, you know, that's kind of, that makes things different because people know who I am. So it's,
yeah,
it's, it filters out a lot of the sorts of people, I think.
Yeah. And again, I appreciate you taking the time to talk about Sex at Dawn because, you know, even though I just read it or listened to it, I know it did come out a while ago and I was like chomping at the bit to see, you know, like talk through some of this stuff because I like asking questions when I read and like the, you know, the pages look like shit when I'm done. So even though it came out a while ago, I appreciate you talking about it. I know people are still buying the book as they should be and reading it and hopefully thinking for themselves. And I also want to encourage people to pick up Civilized to Death and Sex at Dawn because they're both intriguing, thought-provoking reads. And there's also overlap too. They're different books, different arguments, but there's if you read one and then you go to the next one, like for me, it's been a very enjoyable experience.
Thanks, man. Yeah, there's definitely overlap. It's sort of the same perspective on two different aspects of life.
Yeah. So as we end off in the last few minutes, I had a last question with you, if I can find it, if I can locate the question. Oh, okay. So on Joe Rogan, you mentioned that you may have an erotic memoir dropping sometime around your 60th birthday.
Did I say that?
Yes, oh, yes. Shit. You mentioned you may have an erotic memoir dropping sometime around your 60th birthday. And from Wikipedia, I understand that you are 60, so yeah. What you read on the internet has to be true. So I wanted to ask you, in terms of erotic memories, things that may make it into the book, even if it doesn't come out, is there anything you've learned in sexual situations or just something that comes to mind of how the world is incredibly different than what people think? Is there something that pops out to you that's been tied to a lesson where you're like, this is like number one, this definitely has to make it into that book. Like I'm going to lead with this for the erotic memoir.
Oh man. Yeah. That's an interesting question. And I would say there are a bunch of things like that, which is why I'm tempted to write that kind of book, you know, because I feel like I've had experiences repeatedly that have shown me that like, oh, that nobody would believe this, right? If I told people this, it just is so outside of the realm of what people think is normal or possible. But yeah, I mean, one thing that has happened repeatedly in my life is, and see, this is the thing. This is when I said I might write that book, I probably also said that it would be the last book I wrote because it will like sink any sort of respectable career path that I might have. So I'm hesitant to talk too much about that. But
we could tease the torpedo if you'd like. You don't have to fully torpedo yourself on the podcast, but if there's something
tease the torpedo, that's yes. What she said, right?
Exactly. Is that's chapter one. That's chapter one. Chris Ryan, tease the torpedo.
yeah, I mean, I would say, you know, one theme in my life starting like way back, like in college, probably, maybe even high school, was guys who were cool with me being with their girlfriend or wife. Guys who literally said to me like, hey, dude, Michelle really likes you and I just want you to know, I think you're cool. And if you want to be with Michelle, that's okay with me. Mm. The first time that happened, I was just like, what? I don't even know what to say. I don't know how to respond to that. And then, you know, it happened more and more and more. And eventually I came to realize that, you know, a lot of both female and male sexuality are so much more complex than we think. And in some ways, I think we underestimate the complexity of male sexuality more just because we sort of all acknowledge that women are complicated, but we're like, oh, dudes are all the same. Well, they're not. And there are a lot of guys who either get turned on by another guy being with their woman or who just aren't bothered by it and are just so relaxed and secure in themselves that it's like, oh, she wants to be with him. He doesn't seem threatening. He's not trying to steal her. He's not going to talk shit about me behind my back. Why not? There are a lot more people like that than we think. And, you know, there are a lot of people sort of keeping their secrets to themselves, and you know, you're hanging out with them at the bar and at your cocktail party, and everyone's pretending they're normal. And there's a lot less normal than people assume. And a lot of the sort of, you know, I mean, as I said, I've had these experiences throughout my life where people sort of let me in, like behind the scenes at what's really going on in intimate areas of their lives, which I always consider to be a huge honor when somebody shares that stuff with me, whether it's a woman or a dude or, you know, whatever, talking about their private life. That's just so trusting. And, you know, I feel really grateful for that. But then after Sex at Dawn came out, it just went into turbo overdrive where, you know, everybody wanted to tell me about their secrets and their, you know, stuff that nobody else knows about. So, yeah, I would just say that, you know, looking for one particular thread would be that there's a lot more going on than meets the eye.
Yeah, there's a lot of weird people, not even just sexually weird, but anything weird, that are a lot of weird people that are walking around silently assuming that the person that they're talking to isn't going to be into that idea or kink or activity, whatever it is that they're afraid to say to the other person. And I've been there where I have that thing in my head and I'm thinking, like, you know, is this a terrible idea? Will this just destroy the rapport for an entire evening?
Yeah.
And, you know, I've been on the opposite end of that too, where, you know, I've been talking to a girl for the whole night, you know, I know that it's in the bag, like I could tell, like, she wants to head back. And then she says something and like some dark, sick, twisted joke pops into my head and we don't have the same sense of humor. And I'm like, part of me is like, if you don't say this, like, your night will be so much easier. And then I say it, and that just, like, she's like, yeah, I think I'm going to go. And I'm like, all I had to do was keep my mouth shut. But then you meet the person who you say that to, and they're like, I was thinking the same fucking thing. Like, let's get out of here. Like, so there's a lot of, it saves time to show your weirdness. That's how I've started to think about it, is whether it's, you know, in business or like business relationships, personal relationships, romantic relationships, if you say the thing up front that you're thinking, it forces the other person's hand where they either have to say, yeah, I'm into this, or no, that's not the thing for me. But then if you're kind of in this gray space of hinting at shit, then you may be wasting a lot of time with a person, you know, trying to close a deal that in the end is not for both of you, when you could have just figured it out right away. Like, yep, I want this, or no, fuck that. Like, nothing personal, just not into it.
Yeah. I mean, that's, you really articulated an insight that I had when I went through this period where I sort of realized I was not monogamous by nature. And that's when I shifted my PhD research to human sexuality and prehistory. And I was living in Barcelona. I just had like a pretty rough breakup. And I was kind of, looking back on it, I think I was kind of depressed. You know, I was just like, I don't give a shit, you know, whatever. And those three things sort of all came together. And so I would meet women and they'd say, so, you know, what do you do? And I'd say, well, I'm working on a PhD. And, oh, what's it about? Well, it's about how, you know, humans are by nature a promiscuous species and monogamy is a cultural construct. And I knew that, I thought that 99% of the women I said that to would like just get up and leave. In fact, about half of them did. But it's exactly what you said. The half who didn't were really interesting. And it saved a ton of time. You know, why go on a bunch of dates and, you know, have awkward conversations and, you know, then have sex a few times and then explain, I'm not going to be your boyfriend because I'm not, you know, looking for this. Like that takes weeks. Whereas if you just say it right away, yeah, okay, half the people are going to get up and say, nice to meet you, see you later. But that saves a ton of time. And then the people who get through that filter are the people you actually do want to spend time with. So yeah, that's a big insight, I think. And also just to like not chase women because they're hot. Like that takes time to get over. Like to have a more sophisticated understanding of what attractiveness is.
Yeah. And like beauty in line with just right off the bat, hot attractiveness, like totally different things. The way you perceive someone as beautiful, the way that they're put together, their mind, body, spirit, that whole connection versus I see this girl, she's hot as fuck, know nothing about her, just like that pure instinctual attention grabbing. It's like clickbait almost. And then you have to go into the article and see, you know, is there actually something there?
And also, you respond to a woman like that, she already loses respect for you because she knows all you're responding to is the surface.
Yeah.
Right? Like, you don't know me. Why do you want to talk to me? Why do you want to hang out? Oh, because of the way I look. That's all. You're a shallow dude, right? Even if she's putting herself together in order to elicit that response, she still doesn't really respect it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's so. Like, I mean, this could be a whole nother podcast, but like the how women from all the entire spectrum. So like, you know, the girls who are not as attractive all the way up to the hottest girls, how they perceive when a guy approaches them. And I would guess that from the hottest girl's perspective, and I've had a few conversations with female athletes back in the day when I was playing baseball, because we would get together like lacrosse team, soccer team, baseball team, and just like smoke and fucking talk about shit. And something that came up was like when guys would approach these girls that were very attractive, but then start like complimenting them right away or looking to get in with them somehow, that made them cautious. Like it put a wall up, because then that girl was thinking like, what have I done to prove that I'm worth this? Like, what are you after? Almost all you see is that I look good in this dress and these heels and I have a beautiful face, but like other than that, what is causing you to show me these like good deeds in a sense, or like you kind of like falling over yourself? It, like, there must be some, I mean, I know there has to be some evolutionary thing where if someone's showing you too much kindness right off the bat, it kind of just, you're like, what is this? This is weird. Like, I'm sure you've gotten that more than a few times where someone's just like being way too nice to you, and then you get the vibe, you know, what is this about? Like, this can't be all me, because this person doesn't know me yet. They might have listened to the podcast or something, but like I'm not the person you think I am.
Yeah, definitely. I used to live with fashion models. I don't know if you've ever heard me talk about this. I lived in a mansion full of fashion models. So
yeah, I saw that you your first master's thesis was about psychology of fashion models, but I didn't know you live with fashion models too.
Yeah, that's why I did it, because I was just living in this mansion full of fashion models and I needed a quick thesis. So I was like, fuck it, I'll just give everybody a questionnaire and, you know, boom, there's my master's thesis.
There you go. Let's pick up there for round two. Let's start. We'll start with the fat. We started with the metaverse and then went into sex at dawn. We'll start with the fashion models and then go into civilized to death next time. And then thank you so much for your time, Chris. This has truly been a blast. You know, this is something I was looking forward to. I was very curious to pick your brain and talk to you through this condom, this conversational condom of
the icon
remote. So yeah, hopefully we'll get the chance to fuck, you know, we'll raw it one day, and then you know, but either
back in Brooklyn.
Bareback in Brooklyn. Good also a good name for a chapter.
That'll be your book.
Yeah, Tease the Torpedo, Bareback in Brooklyn. Thank you so much, Chris. As we end off, where can people check you out? Twitter, Instagram, website, stuff like that. I'll link everything in the podcast description.
Yeah, my website is thatchrisryan.com, and I've got a whole thing going on in Substack, just Substack, or it's chrisryan.substack.com.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's where I post most often now.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much, Chris.
All right. Thanks, Zach.